Painting is really slow. It's a time-based medium. It requires a certain kind of investment of time and looking to get all of what's really going on in the painting.
Says Julie Meritu. Her abstract paintings often start with images of political protests, immigrant detention centers, or ecological disasters. And she's also inspired by art history from the Renaissance to Romanticism. Julie Meritu is based in New York City and currently has a mid-career retrospective at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. I would like to start with your show in Berlin right now. When I went close to the paintings, it was very surprising how your technique is present and how sometimes it's even deceiving. You would think, oh, this looks like a template or like a spray painted feature. And then you go really, really close, almost like super close. And then it's visible that it's actually a print. Like you see the texture of the screen from the screen print on the canvas. And then you see more and more layers. How often do you go over them? How many layers are there? Because it seemed indefinite.
Yeah, it really does depend on the painting, to be honest. They are very intuitively developed. So some of them, usually they begin with some kind of obscured image, blurred or pixelated somehow, because it's not so much the recognizability of the image that I'm interested in, but what the image kind of brings up in terms of what's embedded inside of it and in the light, in the color, in the moment, in the action of the image. So that's usually the point of departure. And then after that, sometimes it can just be a layer of airbrush painting. Other times it can be layers of drawing with ink and airbrush painting and painting again more with ink and then erasing and then screen printing onto that. Usually the paint that you're talking about that looks like spray paint is actually is digitally sprayed. So it's done in Photoshop and then screen printed. So it actually does become pixelated and atomized. There's a couple paintings in that show that are very, very layered and others that are much more direct, but almost feel much more layered because of optical illusions that happen in the paintings or optical kind of things, tricks.
So can we imagine you in your studio with lots of paintings around you that you walk back a couple of steps, you look at them over a period of weeks and months and maybe years, and then you go over them again? How many unfinished works surround you in your studio when you work?
Well, I mean, that also depends on where I am and what kind of project or exhibition or thoughts I'm working through. But a lot of the paintings that were in the exhibition were paintings that did come up together. And right now, for example, there's 10 unfinished paintings in the studios at different stages. Some are finished and some are really halfway there. Sometimes it takes me 2 years just to get back into the blur of an image to really understand even how to approach it. Other times, I can really finish a painting in a month. I usually try to spend a lot of time with the paintings, even after they're finished. I'd like to have them in the studio. Time doesn't always work that way, but painting is really slow. It's a time-based medium. It requires a certain kind of investment of time and looking to get all of what's really going on in the painting. And so I think I try to make sure I have that. And once it's really finished, it's very clear usually that it's at its final point.
Where's your studio?
It's on the West Side Highway on 26th Street in the Starrett Lehigh Building in New York City. But I also have a studio. I live in Harlem and I also have a home studio here.
So the home studio is probably for smaller works and maybe watercolors, little prints?
Drawing smaller paintings. I can bring decent-sized paintings home. We also have a studio upstate in the Catskills near this nonprofit project collective, artist collective that we've started called Denniston Hill. And so there's studio space up there, too, that we use.
In the motifs that you have in your paintings at this current Berlin show, I was also struck by a kind of a ghostly shape of a human figure that I only saw after a little while. It looked like almost like someone with their arms outstretched. And it seemed like this is a figure that evolved during the painting process. It didn't look to me like something that was there as a source image, but more something that came about with the later layers of color that you applied. How did this figure come about? And what do you think it means in your work? Did you see it from the beginning?
Over the past, 5 years, more and more the marks and this kind of disembodied parts, like body parts would appear in the painting. The marks start to have these references and like start to play with things. And I started to push that and play with that more. And you have like sometimes marks that coalesce into some type of a figure that then disappears, or part of a body or part of a torso or arms or a cut off foot. And I think like There's several pieces that are in the show where I was actually really drawing after Jericho's drawings of corpses and kind of the suggestion of these almost apparitions in the painting. I think in a way they've emerged naturally and intuitively in the drawing process. There's something about the way that I'm working with the marks and the kind of play between. It's almost it participates in the kind of visual neologistic way that I think around mark making and visual language. There can be these moments of parts of figures or emergent parts of figures that are participating in the kind of other language that's happening and how one can engage with these, where they melt between becoming something that is a narrative and then something completely just experiential or abstract. That visceral flow between that, the haunting figure that kind of comes in and out of focus, but participates in the larger gesture, visceral kind of experience of the painting, I think is part of what I'm interested in that.
These works look so contemporary, of course, but when you look closely, like you mentioned Jericho, the raft of the Medusa, you really see these parts of people that are falling off the raft. Earlier works of yours, there's a certain precision and a certain shapes that remind one of satellites, things orbiting, some kind of space, always a lot of movement and a lot of, you're drawn into it and you're spun around in these works. When I think of the new work now and how it developed, I find that it's as if your earlier work was an exploration of space and your current work I see as an exploration of time in a way. Also, going back, of course, thousands of years, because there are things that look like cave painting, even the colors sometimes. I mean, there's these marks that transcend hundreds or thousands of years. Do you see that too?
You're touching on something really true. But it's interesting, I've never thought about the newer work as this kind of exploration of time in that way, and the other as an exploration of space. But I think that's a really interesting kind of matrix to see them. I think, like, there's this really clear sense of distance with the older paintings, this kind of either map-like perspective, aerial perspective, or even immense distance, even with the enormous kind of 25-foot like paintings that are fully immersive experiences, you still have these kinds of, especially with the architectural drawing, these like signifiers of scale. Like if you draw a window at a particular scale or and however big, that always creates a kind of relative scale to the experience of the viewer and the experience of seeing these paintings. And I think that created this immense distance. So that's what I think you're referring to, the distance from which you're seeing these. Even when you come up close to them and you're completely immersed inside of them, you still have this kind of visual reference of scale. And so one of the reasons I actually left that form of that language is because I became much more interested in that immersive experience inside the paintings, where that sense of scale disappears and one can be like embedded inside that visceral experience. So I think it's so interesting you think of that as, or refer to that as time. And I really love the way that you see some of these marks as going back hundreds of thousands of years. So you can go back, so not hundreds of thousands, but, you know, 60,000 years in terms of mark making. There is this rich language that we all understand, and they all participate in the kind of concept of the construction of the neologism in the visual, and being able to then kind of try to invent new forms of language from these parts of the language that of our past, and trying to reconstruct a kind of visceral experience through this kind of intuitive way that we understand visual signifiers and signs and motion and color and temperature. We have, in time, as you say, we have these ways of experiencing that. And a lot of that is being shifted by the mediated world we live in and the rate at which we consume images. So something about the kind of immense immersive experience in the paintings is something I'm really interested in. And if you think of them as time, then I would say that time is slow and thick and fully like molasses, like encompassing, like it's visceral. It's a viscous material, I would say.
I was shown around in the gallery, and there was one painting that was actually, of course, not for sale because it was recently sold. You gave it to a benefit auction for Art for Justice, and it made a really high price, something like $6 million. So, of course, you are a great supporter of this cause. Can you say a little bit about this organization, Art for Justice, and how you support it?
Art for Justice is an organization that was started by Agnes Gund, and she sold a major work of hers, a Liechtenstein, I think it was, for really over $150 million or something, I don't remember exactly, but an enormous amount that began this fund. And she did this along with the help of Darren Walker at the Ford Foundation. They started this fund as a way to end mass incarceration. And this money was not put aside to start an endowment, but it was actually put to actually get and support initiatives to change laws and to change conditions so that we can end the state of mass incarceration in the United States, which is a huge problem. I think one of our largest and societal problems in addition to policing. And I think that this is nothing that people don't know, but it's a form of enslavement and a form of really laws that were really pretty racist and designed in ways to then really keep black folks in prison in this country and put black folks in prison at the highest numbers of any country of our sort. Like, we are the most incarcerated country on the planet. And that doesn't make sense for something like the United States in the 21st century. It's not just doesn't make sense, it's systematically racist. And so to me, it's one of the main issues of our current moment, in addition to problems around migration and climate catastrophe and global warming. These are, to me, an abolitionist in a way. I don't believe in the carceral state in that sense. And I think that especially as the kind of people that we can be and how we can live in the 21st century, there are other ways of negotiating justice and working out these kinds of systems. And so to me, the minute she started this, I wanted to also support. And we were looking for the right time, and I needed to find the right time. And then we had like the pandemic and the show got postponed and all these things happened. But it turned out we ended up doing it around the same time that my show was at the Whitney, which was a great time, I think, for the sale and for the support of the fund. And really, the intention to make the fund, like to let more people know about the fund and try to have more support. I mean, Agnes Gund's initial gift, I think it's been 5 years being used, and a lot of other people have contributed, but the more contributions, the better. And the fund has served and given grants to really amazing projects by either previously incarcerated artists and other types of art programs. But it's also really working with to lobby certain legal projects around the law, around ending and changing laws that lead and cause mass incarceration.
Often the underlying images that you use for your large paintings come from protests. I've seen in your new catalog images of anti-war protests, anti-immigration protests, Catalan secessionist protests. Do you go to protests too?
You know, my interest in that form of social action is in the kind of continuity of that over time, like this form and the co-option of that, like as well. And so I describe it one time, like, you know, I come from the 70s. I was born in a time just 4 years before the major revolution in Ethiopia and before these huge shifts that were taking place across the continent and the kind of decolonial project that was happening, or, you know, and while that, and so like that, the concept of revolution, the kind of desire of revolution and the kind of possibilities of, and the real dream of revolution is almost like in me on a cellular level. It's like so embedded. But at the same time, the failure of that is also very much a part of me, and very much a kind of real felt and seriously impactful part of my life experience. And so and the kind of continuation of those failures and the co-option of those gestures. And so there's this ambivalence at the same time, a kind of serious ambivalence and questioning of that, those forms of gestures. So it's the two sides of the kind of possibility of collective action and what can happen on that level, and then the kind of, and the serious advances that have been made by collective action, especially in this country, but also the kind of the quick co-option or shift or effort to insist on a different form of systematic kind of racism or systematic colonialism or systematic forms of like oppression that or extraction that fundamentally undermine and kind of consume or digest those things. So it's just this entropic kind of state that I'm interested in, and I think that is part of the investigation of what my is like deeply embedded in my psyche, that I'm always kind of trying to understand or push or interrogate in painting.
So there are many layers to your biography too. You lived on different continents. You studied in I mean, you moved when you were a child, you moved to the US, to Michigan, then you studied, you went back to Africa, to Senegal to study, and then back to the US. You were in Berlin for a while. How long were you in Berlin for?
A couple of years, yeah.
When you look back on your time in Berlin, what does Berlin mean to you in your biography?
Well, Berlin is really important to us. We lived there when we had our first child, and we really, I think, learned how to become through our community of friends there, and through the way that one can live in Berlin as an artist and with children. And how the city is kind of embraces children and families and that form of living. We really, I think, learned how to be artist parents in Berlin, like how to be able to live in full in both capacities. And we made very, very dear friends there. Tacita Dean and Matthew Hale and Rufus Hale, they're very close friends of ours, and many others as well, many other friends who were in Berlin. And there was a way of kind of, they also had children, and we were able to really, so build a way of like being able to be immensely creative, really all immersed in our work, have get together for dinners and our children, and be able to, you know, our kids went to Kita together, and there was a way of like, there was a develop a community and really serious thinkers and really interesting artists. So It became that's why we got an apartment there and why we continue to go back and spend summers there. And the children love it. And there's a certain kind of freedom and space.
Did your parents' profession have an impact on your motifs? Is that something that's visualized in some of your works? And also the Montessori aspect of your mother, is that something that you feel in your art?
I think that there's no way to deny the immense influence that my parents' form of thinking and being has had on my sense of the construction of the world. Definitely the Montessorian kind of approach and the kind of thinking through the world in the way the Montessorian technique is taught, but also the sense of like being in the world and this and responsibility and interrogation of its construction and the ethics and kind of thinking around distribution and the constructs of how we live. All of this is stuff that was debated, thought through, interrogated in our family. And I think the core of my father's work, but also both my parents as being people of their generation who were invested in building a different form of a world. You know, they met in the U.S. and they got married a few years after the anti-miscegenation law was passed. And so really we're talking about a form of like, they were world builders of a different nature. They're part of the civil rights movement. They're part of the decolonization movement. They were part of the build a new kind of Africa movement. So this was a really, that is the generation that I was born into. And that really was very formative in terms of a lot of our thinking. Again, failure was a big part of that. And the failures of some of a lot of those gestures. And then, you know, we left the country and I was raised in Michigan, which is where my father started to work and my mother started to teach. So all of that has been really formative. But I don't really see the work as kind of necessarily visualizing their work or, you know, it's more kind of the kind of spirit of the world we were raised into and how we negotiated that as a family that had to leave and kind of start their own world in a very foreign place.
You went to Rome quite a bit as a child, right? Or as a youth?
Since college. My father, about 30 years, he did a Rome program through the university in the summers. So he and my mother would spend the summers in Rome. That started about right when I went to university. So it was a great moment to spend time with them. And then, so for the last 30 years almost, I've been going to Rome almost every summer. And the kids, since they were very young, have been going to Rome to see my parents every summer. So it became, and it was also a big part of my education, like going to Rome and spending that kind of time in Rome, in terms of Renaissance painting and Renaissance art in general and the study of that.
There's a very Baroque quality to many of your works. When I think of, you know, Bernini and the whirling around and the multitude of perspectives, I see that in your work too.
Very much informed by Rome, of looking and learning in Rome.
Caravaggio is also an artist that you saw in Rome. Does he have an impact on you too?
Yes, without a doubt. I think if I were to say one kind of installation or one major work that It would be the cycle, the St. Matthew. I think that's at the French church in Rome. Like I said, for the past 30 years, visited those paintings, seen those paintings almost every single year, and sometimes more than one, you know, more than once a year. And I'm always taken by them afresh every time, and learn something else every time I'm in front of them. And their site specificity to like what really unfolds inside of them and how they relate to one another. I'm just completely taken by them, and they're one of my favorite, inspiring works. Every time I'm moved and pushed in a different way. So he's definitely an enormous influence. I mean, not influence, that's the wrong word for someone so giant, but an enormous figure, an enormous important artist for me.
If time travel was real, what place and period would you visit?
I guess I'd want to go into the future. I don't know where. Wherever my like children's children are.
What's your most important tool?
My most important tool is my brush.
If you were an animal, what would it be?
I don't know, a horse.
Which game do you like to play?
Monopoly.
What's your favorite color?
Sunset.
Do you have a recurring dream?
Yes. It's a strange dream of multiple cities piled on one another, where I'm always experiencing these places, but it's all these different cities that are merged into one another. Like, it's very hard to explain, but yeah, that space is very familiar in the dream each time, but the narrative of the dream changes.
Do you listen to music while you work?
Yes. I listen to books on tape, I listen to podcasts, I listen to all kinds of music, usually all the time when I'm really lost in painting.
Which topic would you like to see an entire issue of Weltkunst?
Decolonialism, like in terms of thoughts around migration and climate change.
Can you share a wisdom?
It reminded me of a proverb that Paul Holdengraber shares on his podcast. It was something that his mother said, that we have two ears and one mouth.
I thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Weltkunst podcast Was macht die Kunst is brought to you in association with Christie's. And here's a message from our partner. This November, the 20th, 21st century Amsterdam online sale returns, bringing together an exciting selection of works by leading modern and contemporary artists. Open for bidding from the 11th November, highlights include masterpieces by Martin Kippenberger, Sam Francis, Arnulf Reiner, and Daniel Richter. Presented alongside the regular 20th, 21st century sale is 1,000 Roads, a private collection in Rome, an online auction featuring names including Camille Claudel, Georges van Drongelo, Alexander Calder, among others, open for bidding from 9th November. Visit our Christie's Amsterdam galleries from 8th November and explore 1,000 Roads, a private collection in Rome, and highlights from the 20th, 21st century Amsterdam online sale.